Well, it's good to be with you guys. I don't know what Richard's got going on in his life where he would need a break. But evidently, I did look, today is National Puppy Day. So maybe that's what Richard's, maybe they got a new puppy or something like that. It's also World Meteorological Day. We have Chris Bruin in here? No, he's probably out celebrating. Where's it? Yeah, probably at the Waffle House celebrating. But this is the real reason why Richard is not here, because it is International Goof Off Day. You can Google it. It is. It's actually International Goof Off Day. So we know what he'll be doing the rest of this afternoon. So anyway, it's good to be with you guys. Looks like we will have today and next Sunday together. So I want to take today and next week to look at a section of scripture from the Old Testament book of Ecclesiastes. A book that I have found extremely relevant to everyday life. Unfortunately, a book that's been often ignored and misunderstood by many Christians. Some have described Ecclesiastes as fatalistic, pessimistic, nihilistic, skeptical, cynical. A couple of commentators refer to it as the black sheep of the Bible or the problem child of Scripture. Which is ridiculous. I think you approach this book with the right attitude and right heart, and pay attention to the details. But it's essentially necessary wisdom for Christian living. It's wisdom literature, along with other Old Testament books such as Song of Solomon, Job. You have wisdom Psalms. Of course, the Book of Proverbs, books that deal with various aspects of our existence. Proverbs, again, looks at demands of practical good management in life. Job deals with the enigma of calamities that are beyond our explanation and beyond our control. And Ecclesiastes, it addresses this brevity of human life and how we are to live as believers skillfully and calmly and stably, not when things go wrong, but in a world that is wrong. A world that has been, as Paul says in Romans chapter 8, subjected to futility. A fallen world. Luther summed it up this way. He said this, Solomon wants to put us at peace and to give us a quiet mind in the everyday affairs and business of this life so that we may live contentedly in the present without care and yearning about the future. So Ecclesiastes, I refer to it sometimes as an application commentary of Genesis 3. To understand what's really going on in Ecclesiastes, you have to be very familiar with what takes place at the fall in Genesis 3. And so when you read this particular book, Solomon's cynicism, what people often point out is cynicism, isn't really cynicism, it's simply realism in a world still laboring under the curse of sin. Ian Provan, in his commentary, said this, the difficulty, and he's addressing this, of course, when people approach this book, they're like, it's just, I don't understand it, it doesn't make any sense. But he says this, the difficulty may be that the book speaks truly about reality while we are devoted to illusions. The difficulty may be that we are not too keen to embrace the truth, but prefer to embrace half-truths and lies. Another said this of Ecclesiastes, if you want to know what is happening these days, it's all right here, right? I mean, it so accurately describes what we actually experience in day-to-day life. So it's wisdom for a fallen world, it's wisdom in a fallen world, wise counsel for, you might say, reducing the frustration in a fallen world. So it's Solomon's counsel regarding injustice and regarding issues like oppression and work, popularity and companionship, money, political corruption, and so forth. And also wise warnings about the misuse of wisdom. Again, Solomon is our teacher, the king of Israel, who was endowed with wisdom by God, wisdom that exceeded all others. In addition, he was given by the Lord great wealth and power, but unfortunately, Solomon misused the gifts that God had given him and along the way lost his bearings. Solomon, we read about this in Kings, began to love and to fear the wrong things. So he was a man of wisdom, man of great honor, man of great wealth and power, but was gripped in his heart with the wrong affections, and that led him off course. And his message to this assembly, I mean, that's basically this when he starts out and talks about, refers to himself as the preacher, it's basically one who stands before an assembly. His message to this gathering of people, as he articulates this wisdom for life, he actually refers to his son in chapter 12. So it's, in some ways, it's as if it's, you might call it parental wisdom. This parental wisdom, this parental message to the gathering, to the congregation, to the assembly, is not that nothing matters. Because that's what people often assume when they read this book, is that, well, it just sounds like nothing really matters. It's actually the total opposite of that. Solomon's message to the congregation is everything matters. Everything matters. That life is important because it's the only arena of opportunity and significant accomplishment available to man before he steps out into eternity. And his life, man's life, is intended to be lived for God. Now, clearly the term Hevel in the Old Testament is this term vanity. It's translated in most of your translations as vanity. But clearly this particular term is a word that punctuates this book as few others do. You'll notice it there if you just want to look at chapter 1. Ecclesiastes 1, verse 2, you're familiar with this. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Which is somewhat repeated near the end. You could go to the end of the book, chapter 12, verse 8. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. Part of the challenge in interpreting this book is just understanding that word itself. There's a lot of disagreement about its particular meaning and how the term should be translated. The three main ideas is it's referring to something that is empty, or it could be something you might say that is enigmatic, something that's perplexing, that's hard to understand, or it's ephemeral, simply meaning it's short-lived. It doesn't last very long. In fact, that word ephemeral is actually a medical term to just simply mean lasting only a day. So it was used to describe, for instance, a fever. So it's ephemeral fever. It was there, but it was there for a brief time, and then the fever broke. So some of the disagreement is around, well, what is it what meaning is Solomon in particular sort of employing in this book? When Solomon says that all is vanity or that life is vanity, does he mean that life is empty, that it lacks substance and it fails to satisfy us? Does he mean that life is enigmatic, that it's perplexing, that it's puzzling and leaves us with a lot of unanswered questions? Or does it mean that life is simply brief, that it's short-lived, it's fleeting, like your breath on a cold day, that it's this sort of this vapor-like existence? And after studying this book a number of years ago, my conclusion is it's all of those things. He's using the term, and he uses it in different ways, and you can just, if you just pay attention to the context in those different passages, each of the different passages that have this particular term have their own focus, and context indicates which focus is in view. That being said, I do believe it's this third option that is most prevalent in Ecclesiastes, this idea that life is short under the sun. Other writers use this word Hevel and use it in this particular way. Job chapter 7, verse 16, Job said, I waste away, I will not live forever. Leave me alone, for my days are but breath. That's the word Hevel. Psalm 39, David writes in verse 4, Lord, make me to know my end and what is the extent of my days. Let me know how transient I am. Behold, you have made my days as handbreadths and my lifetime as nothing in your sight. Surely every man at his best is a mere Hevel, is a mere breath. Similar to what we see in Job chapter, or saw there in Job chapter 7, describing the life of a man as something that is passing and brief. Psalm 144, verse 4, O Lord, what is man that you take knowledge of him, or the son of man that you think of him? Verse 4, man is like a mere hevel. Man is like a mere breath. His days are like a passing shadow. So the predominant, I think, meaning in Ecclesiastes is this sense of change. It's things are changing. Things are moving. Life is something that is here but soon gone, and it's made up of moments that are here and then fade very quickly. I mean, we have twin granddaughters that turned 3 on Friday. My youngest son is going to be in next month turning 21, and I'm thinking, where has the time gone? I mean, can anybody identify with this sort of fleeting, passing, vapor-like thing that declares, okay, thank you, Mark. We'll meet afterwards and discuss. Yeah, so it's where has the time gone? I mean, we got 2 funerals this week in the church. We got Christopher Sparkman's sister who passed away. We got Eric Wren's funeral on Tuesday. It's just this idea of it's there and then it's gone by and we've missed it. And again, you could look at that in a pessimistic way is, well, what's the point? I mean, things just keep changing and moving and passing away. Or you could look at it the other way and say, maybe we should take advantage of all those moments, right? Everything matters. So Solomon begins by declaring the vanity of life under the sun, but Ecclesiastes isn't about some kind of skeptical agnosticism. It's about enjoying life as a gift from God. It's about exercising reverent faith and trust in God. It isn't simply a message about futility. It is a message of hope. Ecclesiastes represents the painful autobiography of Solomon, who for much of his life squandered God's blessings on his own personal pleasure rather than God's glory. This was Israel's most powerful king at the end of his life, I believe, feeling powerless, unable to control his life, unable to control what happens to his work and wealth after his death, unable to prevent his death. At one point in his life, surrounded by success and affluence and pleasure, but later hitting rock bottom in his miserable existence, sort of returning, if you will, from the mire, repenting from idolatry, returning to the Lord, and never really giving up his belief in God, not always understanding the plan, those sort of inner workings of God's creation and the personal providence of God, sometimes frustrated, and you'll see that in the verses we're going to look at, sort of frustrated by the plan, but ultimately embracing the plan and coming to the right conclusions. And then writing to warn subsequent generations not to make the same tragic error. Living with a burning desire to teach these life-saving truths, helping us to know how fulfilling life can be when we see things from God's perspective. So again, everything matters. And the more we study this book, the better I think we understand why. Now, we obviously don't have time to cover all of it. We're actually going to sort of parachute into the middle of chapter 9. But by this point in the book, there are 2 things that have become abundantly clear to the reader. First of all, the reader has learned that life is a weary business. It's a weary business. And secondly, the reader has learned that it is impossible to know for certain what God is doing in the world. That is to say, we see God's work, we recognize it as God's work, but we fail to understand it, you might say, in the details. I mean, we can see the broad outlines, and we understand God is at work in all things, but we're talking about those particular things that God causes to happen, God allows to happen, and what he's trying to accomplish through that. So we're living in a world where we've got basically billions, that's generating billions and billions of gigabytes of digital information every year. None of that data could even begin to explain, Solomon says, the mysteries of God, the sovereignty of God. Many things are simply beyond our capacity to know. So how do we respond to that kind of limitation? Well, some people look at all the confusion in the world and conclude that there is no God. So they just see all of these, what they would call very random things. They try to look at the patterns and then they see the inconsistencies in that and they just walk away saying, well, I guess there is no God. It's all All these things are happening by accident. It's like a line from Shakespeare's Macbeth. They believe that life is only a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury signifying nothing. That's their worldview. That's the way they interpret all these things that they deal with on a day-to-day and week-to-week basis. Others may think that although there may be a God, God obviously doesn't know what he's doing. So there's a God, but he just doesn't understand. He's not wise. He's not all-knowing. They imagine him to be asleep at the wheel or like someone that's disinterested and disengaged, but not Solomon. As sure as he is about his inability to know the mind of God, he nevertheless believes that what happens in the world is the work of God. God exists, and Solomon is convinced that he isn't limited in his understanding or power. And yet Solomon acknowledges that there are mysteries about life that we cannot comprehend. The fact is, some people expect to have all the answers. When they fail to discover them, they get angry with God. They get angry and frustrated about what is happening or not happening. But wisdom says God is sovereign and you are finite. You are limited. Wisdom understands that. As Solomon stated in chapter 9, verse 1, that righteous and wise men and their deeds are in the hand of God. But it also knows that being in the hand of God isn't synonymous with or a guarantee for being economically prosperous or physically healthy or shielded from discomfort and pain. It's not some guarantee that you're going to live as a believer a trouble-free life, that everyone in your life is going to smile and is going to appreciate you. So as the author of the book of Proverbs, Solomon was all for this wisdom. Wisdom was his life. This was the kind of culture that he was in, that intellectual culture that was all about analyzing life and thinking about life and how life works in God's world, and then how you serve God using those wise principles. That was Solomon's environment. That was the air which he breathed as the wisest of all men. But the difficulty with wisdom, as we discover in previous chapters, is the wise use of wisdom. Wisdom needs to be wisely used. We see that, for example, in Proverbs chapter 26, verse 4, do not answer a fool according to his folly, or you will also be like him. Verse 5, answer a fool as his folly deserves, that he will not be wise in his own eyes. So you read those two verses, you say, so what am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to answer? Do I answer a fool or do I not answer a fool? And the answer is this, it will take wisdom to know how to apply this wisdom from Proverbs. That is to say, if you misuse wisdom or if you abuse wisdom, then what you are doing isn't wise anymore. And Solomon was concerned about this because he had witnessed many times in his life others making this tragic mistake, and he also had experienced this misuse of wisdom in his own life and in his own decision making. So this is a theme that surfaces, that what is valuable and God-glorifying, if used in the wrong way, can become detrimental and even idolatrous. Now, the specific abuse of wisdom that Solomon exposes for us in chapter 7 and 8 is the idea that a person can somehow control their future by living righteously and wisely enough, a notion that denies the place of God's sovereignty. And therefore, it would be considered foolish wisdom. Which again, seems to be an oxymoron where the two terms don't go together. It's like it's pretty ugly. Or it's a natural additive. Or for somebody's somewhat addicted, or a tax return. It's just an oxymoron. Nevertheless, it exists, right? Foolish wisdom. Solomon says you cannot back God into a corner with your pseudo-righteous or your formulaic living. And you can't take some verse from Proverbs and turn it into a divine promise and blanket truth without exceptions. And so here in chapter 9, Solomon continues to address the wisdom lovers of his world, those that had a tendency to abuse the book of Proverbs, And he takes the time to bring a form of correction to them in this section from the middle of chapter 9 through the end of chapter 10. A section about the wise use of wisdom. So here's a few questions for you to think about as we kind of work through this. What skill do you sometimes trust in to ensure that things go well with you? What talent do you trust in to make things go well in your life? Or what ability do you utilize to make things go the way that you want them to go and to fix the problem when things aren't going your way in life? Is it your ability to manage the crisis? Is it your ability to, maybe it's just tenacity? Maybe it's your ability to just bear down when things get difficult and to sort of push through things and work a little bit harder. Is it your foresight? Is that what you trust in to make life go the way that you want it? Is it your ability to plan ahead, right? Is it your ability to think about all of the possible contingencies and to come up with how any problem that surfaces can be addressed successfully? John Wooden, this is a former head coach at UCLA, won 10 national titles in 12 years. Someone asked Wooden about the secret to his success in coaching, and he replied simply with this: proper preparation and attention to details. That's my formula for success in coaching: proper preparation and attention to details. That's not bad advice. But will that always safeguard you from adversity and failure? That's the question. And the answer is not according to Ecclesiastes. Or maybe you trust in your physical strength, or maybe it's your wit, or your ability to be liked by others, or your ability to make good conversation, or you trust in your good looks. What skill do you trust in and rely upon to make life go your way? Is it self-discipline? Is it your family's influence in the community? Is it your intelligence? Here's a good reminder for us. Proverbs 18:10, the name of the Lord is a strong tower. The righteous runs into it and is safe. Why is that a good reminder? Because our inclination is to put our confidence in our abilities and skill to get us through. And because it tells us that even though skill and ability and God's gifts aren't bad things, they aren't things that we should trust in or use for our own selfish advantage. But the challenge of this is that Scripture also encourages us to think ahead, right? Scripture encourages us to plan. Scripture encourages us to act, to work hard, and to be diligent. In fact, we are admonished to do those things, those kinds of things, all through the book of Proverbs. And it's wise to do them. But Solomon says in Ecclesiastes, we can abuse wisdom. The person that plans, the self-disciplined person, the one who thinks about every contingency, every possible future event or circumstance, can begin to idolize those skills, acting as if his ability and his skills are his strong tower. It takes wisdom to know how to use and not abuse God's wisdom and the gifts that he has given to us. Now, biblical wisdom from Proverbs is clearly in Solomon's sights as he writes this section. And the wisdom of Proverbs, again, is a very good thing. But some in Solomon's world were teaching as if wisdom were God, elevating skillful management or elevating prudence or planning above God himself, wanting to push proverbial principles into the category of absolute principles so that they could just count on the principles to control the future, not realizing that by doing that, they were no longer trusting in God with their future. Getting to a place, practically speaking, where God is no longer necessary. Because we think we can know a lot about the future, and even when things happen that we don't like, we can just plug in some principle to get us back on track and achieve what we ultimately envision as our goal in life. So there are great benefits to wisdom. Solomon has already made this clear back in Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Verse 12, he said, "So I turned to consider wisdom, madness, and folly, for what will the man do who will come after the king except what has already been done? And I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness." That is to say, wisdom is extremely valuable, but it is not invincible. Now, what about us? Do we still deal with this kind of thinking and this sort of threat in the Christian life? Absolutely. I could be talking to a guy whose wife is threatening to divorce him. I could be counseling a set of parents who have a child that is acting out and rebelling against their authority. My wife could be talking to a single young lady who wants to get married, but it's been a while and there aren't any good prospects in view. What do they all want? A formula. They want a formula. They want to know what steps that they need to follow so that things will go their way, so that their wife will come back, so that their child will turn around, and so that God will give them a husband. That's what they want. They want a guarantee. They want a foolproof recipe, which is a huge problem, I think, with so much of the teaching today in the church. People expect things to work. Sometimes it seems that nobody has more intolerance for dashed expectations than Christians do. So it's time for a reality check. That's what we're going to do. We're getting a reality check this morning in Ecclesiastes chapter 9, and I'm going to go to this first thing. We're going to see the first thing that Solomon tells us, beginning here in chapter 9, verse 11. Solomon reminds us of the uncertainty of outcomes. The uncertainty of outcomes. Ecclesiastes 9:11, "I again saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, and the battle is not to the warriors, and neither is bread to the wise, nor wealth to the discerning, nor favor to men of ability, for time and chance overtake them all. Moreover, man does not know his time, like fish caught in a treacherous net and birds trapped in a snare, so the sons of men are ensnared at an evil time when it suddenly falls on them." You see, we expect life to follow certain predictable patterns. And Solomon illustrates that with five examples in verse 11. Think of it. We expect the fastest runner to win the race. Do we not? We expect that the strongest warrior will win the fight. We expect the skillful to never go hungry. We expect that brilliant analysis will lead to profits in business. We expect that the smart people will be the rich people and that they will be the ones celebrated by society. And guess what? That is often the case. But not always. In other words, that's what everything Ecclesiastes is saying is, yes, the Proverbs are wisdom and they are generally true, but when you get down to the details, the principle is true, but when you get down to the details of life, this is where you start having questions. Because you're not seeing the pattern play out. Those expectations you have are not actually coming to fruition. So what Solomon basically is saying all along the way, as we go through this passage, is you have to expect the unexpected. In verses 1 to 10 of this chapter, Solomon says death is unavoidable, but now he says life is unpredictable. God will dispense the unexpected from time to time, which is why Solomon, up to this point, has encouraged us to enjoy God's gifts, enjoy our work, and expect the unexpected up to and including our death. So we don't necessarily know in the details what God is doing, no matter how strong we are or how smart. Many bad things happen to us in this life, and there's no way for us to predict when they will happen. Life is unpredictable. Its misfortunes are inevitable and often inescapable. And in his mercy, God tells us, think about this, God in his mercy tells us to expect the unexpected. Now, as we walk through the remainder of chapter 9 and into chapter 10, Solomon's going to say a lot about foolish living and about wise living. And it's a difficult section to outline, but I think what Solomon is doing here is he's showing us that wisdom is good, but wisdom also has some limitations, and we need to acknowledge them. Or we could say it this way. Wisdom is valuable, but it's not invincible. Wisdom is valuable, but it's not invulnerable. And Solomon goes back and forth through these verses, highlighting these realities, the reality of wisdom's value and the reality of wisdom's vulnerability. In other words, Solomon is reminding us, our second point here, the parameters of wisdom. The parameters of wisdom. Verse 13, also this I came to see as wisdom under the sun, and it impressed me. There was a small city with few men in it, and a great king came to it, surrounded it, and constructed large siege works against it. But there was found in it a poor wise man, and he delivered the city by his wisdom. Yet no one remembered that poor man. So here we have a small city that is about to be crushed by a superior force, a king or ruler and his army, but the town beggar comes up with a plan to deliver the city. Interestingly, with this, with the mention of this, you see that poor, the NAS says the poor wise man. Solomon is already taking a shot at the wisdom worshipers of his day by even suggesting that this character is both poor and wise. Because according to their view of Proverbs, a wise man wasn't supposed to be poor. Proverbs 15, verse 6. Great wealth is in the house of the righteous, but trouble is in the income of the wicked. Proverbs 22, verse 4. The reward of humility and the fear of the Lord are riches, honor, and life. Proverbs 24, verses 3 and 4. By wisdom a house is built, and by understanding it is established, and by knowledge the rooms are filled with all precious and pleasant riches. Now, we don't know how, but through some brilliant scheme, the siege is broken and the city is saved, and the celebration begins with the citizens of the city. But in the midst of the singing and the dancing and the feasting, the beggar is forgotten as he watches most of what is going on from his shack, unrecognized, still in his poverty, ignored by society, even though it was his idea that led to their rescue. It's not what you expected. Is wisdom good? Yeah, wisdom's good. But it has its limitations. Verse 16, so I said, wisdom is better than strength, but the wisdom of the poor man is despised and his words are not heeded. So wisdom beat the powerful army that was on the attack, and in that sense it is valuable. But in this particular story, wisdom didn't lift this man out of his poverty, as the rules stated was supposed to happen. The rules said that if you were wise, you would stand before kings. You would be exalted. You would be acknowledged. And that does happen sometimes, but not always. Wisdom is valuable, but it is not invulnerable. It's a great and necessary thing, but it's not something that you use as some magical formula to get what you want. This is the pattern that Solomon sets for us and the one that he continues to follow. Verse 17, the words of the wise heard in quietness are better than the shouting of a ruler among fools. Soft, wise words of insight are better than the king's cries and shouts. Think of the Proverbs. Proverbs 16, verse 24. Pleasant words are a honeycomb, sweet to the soul and healing to the bones. Proverbs 15, verse 1. A gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. The tongue of the wise makes knowledge acceptable, but the mouth of fools spouts folly. Verse 4, a soothing tongue is a tree of life, but perversion in it crushes the spirit. Again, wisdom is good. And it's valuable in war. The beginning there, you'll see of verse 18, wisdom is better than weapons of war. It's been said that the greatest generals are those who find a way to win without even fighting. Wisdom is the big gun, but it doesn't solve every problem. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, verse 18, but one sinner destroys much good. That is to say, some opponents in time of war cannot be reasoned with. In some situations, no amount of wisdom will prevent the fighting and the shedding of blood. You can plan wisely, and you should, but one sinner can disrupt and destroy much good. And Solomon just keeps on rolling with a collection of memorable sayings on wisdom and folly, warning the reader of, number three, the unpleasant encounters of life. And he gives us several examples. So he's just sort of saying, listen, this is really what happens in everyday life. So again, it's not cynicism, it's just reality. You're gonna go through these verses and you're going to think of examples in your own life. You're like, yeah, that happened last week. You know, it's like, yep, saw that on TV last night. You know, it's like Solomon's just saying, this is the way it is. He wants to prepare you so that you're not shocked when unpleasant things come. That you don't get into this thinking of, well, if I just do this, if I just appropriate that, if I just apply that truth in my life, I'm gonna know what's coming. I'm going to safeguard my happiness, and I'm going to safeguard my comfort against any sort of calamity. Solomon says, you can't do that. So I'm going to prepare you for reality. You're going to have some unpleasant encounters in life, and he gives us several examples. He says, first of all, that people will encounter folly in the experiences of everyday living. Ecclesiastes 10, verse 1, dead flies make a perfumer's oil stink, so a little foolishness is weightier than wisdom and honor. Let's begin with the picture. Imagine a bottle of the finest, most expensive perfume. Every drop is valuable. And then, ladies, imagine opening up that bottle of perfume and noticing a dead fly floating around inside. Would you just scoop it out and apply the perfume anyway? Probably not. And in a similar way, a lifetime of wisdom can be destroyed by a moment of foolishness. The King James Version sounds a little better, but it smells about the same. Dead flies cause... Sometimes I just enjoy reading the King James when they state these things. Dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savor. So doth a little folly him that is in reputation for wisdom and honor. Nothing was wrong with the fragrance itself, but it had attracted a swarm of flies, and some of those insects had died, and the stench of their carcasses had turned the perfume rancid. What is Solomon's point? Wisdom is sweet, like fragrant perfume, but it doesn't take much foolishness to turn things sour, because folly stinks. An ounce of folly can destroy a ton of wisdom. All it takes is one rash word. I mean, some of you say, you could think of examples. You could think of a situation where somebody said something and you're like, wow. I mean, boy, did that just completely. I see it in counseling a lot. It's like you think things are going well, people are growing, getting along, reconciliation, and then somebody says something. I was in a family mediation several months back, and we had two couples together. The two of them were siblings, and I mean, a years long conflict, and I had all of them share some things to get started, and when the last one shared, she made a comment, and I thought, we're done. Like, this is going, in my mind, I'm just seeing the, you know, like you think it's been a few years, it's like, this is going to be hard to overcome. And we pushed through and we got through it, but I thought, it's worse than it was when we started. Even though I told that, I said, I mean, I literally warned all of them going into that meeting, be careful what you say. Just because you think it, just because you feel it, it may not be what needs to come out of your mouth. And it was just that lack of self-control. Really, it was just what was in her heart that was coming out. One rash word, one rude remark, one hasty decision, one foolish pleasure, one angry outburst. Derek Kidner in his commentary was spot on when he said this: it is easier to make a stink than to create sweetness. So wisdom is good and valuable, but sometimes one sinner can destroy much good, and a little folly can spoil the whole thing. So what do? Do we just give up on godly wisdom? We just say, well, I guess this Proverbs thing, I don't think we need to read that anymore and apply that. Well, Did we just rip the book of Proverbs out of our Bibles? Did we just decide to follow the impulses of our hearts without any concern for the proverbial wisdom of the Old Testament? Of course not. Ecclesiastes 7, verse 16, do not be excessively righteous, do not be overly wise, why should you ruin yourself? Do not be excessively wicked, and do not be a fool, why should you die before your time? Of course we apply God's wisdom. This is where Solomon goes next, verse 2, a wise man's heart directs him toward the right, but the foolish man's heart directs him toward the left, which clearly means that Solomon was a Republican. No, just kidding. Solomon is simply saying that the fool's lack of godly discernment directs him towards the left, which is a place of trouble and disaster, whereas the wise man goes toward the right and finds honor and peace. The New Jerusalem Bible says it this way, the sage's heart leads him aright, the fool's leads him astray. Similarly, he states there in verse 3, even when the fool walks along the road, his sense is lacking and he demonstrates to everyone that he is a fool. That is to say, when a fool walks around, it's as if he is surrounded by a cloud of senselessness, and he tells and declares to others that he is a fool. It's like he's wearing a sign that says, hi, my name is Joel, I'm a fool. It's just that obvious to the people around him, and wisdom protects you and me from that kind of absurdity, that kind of stupidity, and that kind of disaster that comes from ignoring what God has said in Proverbs. And Solomon follows this with another example in verse 4. If the ruler's temper rises against you, do not abandon your position, because composure allays great offenses. He says, if the king or any ruler rages against you, wisdom can diffuse the situation when you realize that his anger isn't personal, and you respond with quiet resilience and reason when you present your viewpoint in a reasonable and a non-threatening manner. But if instead you decide to take the fool's plan and go blow to blow with the king, you're probably going to lose your job and maybe even your life. So once again, wisdom is seen as priceless and invaluable and life-saving, but is it invulnerable? No. Does it mean that wisdom will always protect you from calamity, or that the wise will always be exalted and that the foolish will be cast down in this life? No. Because Solomon also says people will encounter, number 2, incompetence in the halls of government. Verse 5, there's an evil I've seen under the sun, like an error which goes forth from the ruler. Folly is set in many exalted places, while rich men sit in humble places. I have seen slaves riding on horses and princes walking like slaves on the land. Now in verse 7, Solomon isn't talking about the slaves being exalted and that being a good thing. He is saying that men who ought to be slaves because of their foolish living, and princes who should ride on horse because of their wisdom and ability to lead, that they, in a wrong and in an inappropriate way, are doing the opposite. That this should not be the case. But sometimes it is exactly what is going on, because God has decided to break the pattern. And he wants us to be prepared for that. Speed, strength, discernment, wisdom. Usually if you have those kinds of qualities, you do well and you advance. But God will sometimes bring a different result so that you won't trust in your gifts, abilities, and skills. And Solomon just keeps giving us more of the same. Wisdom isn't invincible or invulnerable, but it is valuable. Which is true when it comes to, for example, our work ethic, right? Proverbs extols the value of hard work. Proverbs 10:4, poor is he who works with a negligent hand, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. Proverbs 13, verse 4, the soul of the sluggard craves and gets nothing, but the soul of the diligent is made fat. And Solomon isn't denying those realities, but he is saying that when you work hard, there are certain risks that come with that, that you will encounter, because Solomon also says that men will, thirdly, encounter risk in their labors. Verse 8, he who digs a pit may fall into it, and a serpent may bite him who breaks through a wall. He who quarries stones may be hurt by them, and he who splits logs may be endangered by them. In other words, you might be working hard for months trying to build a well so that you can water your crops or give water to your flocks, and then fall into the hole and break your neck. Or you might be tearing down a wall to put something in its place that will be more productive, and you stick your hand into a cavity in that wall and you get bit by a viper. You might be digging out rock and a large stone fall on you. You might be splitting wood and suffer a life-threatening injury. Again, hard work is great, but it's not an absolute God-trumping formula for success. And hard work is usually profitable, but not so much if you don't work smart. Again, here is another benefit to wisdom. Verse 10, if the axe is dull and he does not sharpen its edge, then he must exert more strength. Wisdom has the advantage of giving success. Verse 11, if the serpent bites before being charmed, there is no profit for the charmer. So in the one case, with the axe, it's folly to hasten, but in the other case, with the snake, it's folly to delay. So again, it's like you're left with this question. So which is it? Which is it, Solomon? Does wisdom give success if it is used wisely, and that only most of the time? So change the oil in your car. Back up the hard drive on your computer. Use your turn signal before you change lanes. Look both ways before you cross the street. And don't stack one ladder on top of two ladders so that you can reach your gutters. Make preparations and take precautions. That is wise living. And it will generally be to your benefit and lead to a longer life, but it won't eliminate all the risk. And it won't guarantee length of days. You might get bitten. And game over. Well, a couple of more. Solomon says people will encounter madness in the conversations they hear. Verse 12, words from the mouth of a wise man are gracious while the lips of a fool consume him. The beginning of his talking is folly and the end of it is wicked madness. Yet the fool multiplies words. No man knows what will happen and who can tell him what will come after him. The toil of a fool so wearies him that he does not even know how to go to a city. Again, Derek Kidner says, So the picture begins to emerge of a man who makes things needlessly difficult for himself by his stupidity. He spouts off about not only what he does not know, but what he cannot know. Not only wearing others out, but wearing himself out. And again, there's a bit of humor here. Notice the fool boasts about his future plans and wearies people with his talk, yet he can't find the way to the city, which in Bible times would have been well marked. That is to say, he is so busy talking about the future that he loses his way in the present. But again, this is the fool that's described for us in Proverbs, right? No fear of God, disregard for God's holiness, impulsively disobedient, lazy, morally blind, unwilling to take advice, directionally challenged, unable to accomplish at times the most intuitive of tasks or to make the simplest of decisions. Again, our expression, he doesn't have enough sense to come in out of the rain. Lastly, Solomon says people will encounter negligence among those entrusted with responsibility. Verse 16, woe to you, O land, whose king is a lad and whose princes feast in the morning. Blessed are you, O land, whose king is of nobility and whose princes eat at the appropriate time for strength and not for drunkenness. Through indolence, the rafters sag, and through slackness, the house leaks. Men prepare a meal for enjoyment, and wine makes life merry, and money is the answer to everything. Here, Solomon describes a situation where a king is in charge of the land, not necessarily a youngster, a lad, like a boy king, but more likely a man who is older but still immature. King Solomon used the term lad this way when he first took the throne in Israel to describe himself, acknowledging his lack of experience before asking God for the wisdom to rule in 1 Kings 3:7. So we have this kingly court where gluttonous princes feast every morning. In Hebrew culture, the morning was used to judge the needs and problems of the people. Late afternoon and evening were the times for feasting. But here were men who indulged themselves all throughout the day, thereby neglecting their duties. Excessive feasting, drunkenness, men using their position of privilege for selfish pleasure, and at the same time destroying the kingdom through their slothfulness and neglect. Leaders having more a sense of entitlement than a sense of responsibility. Rulers indulging in luxury and intemperance, allowing the nation to deteriorate and permitting abuses to flourish, to such a degree that Solomon compares their reckless and dilapidated maintenance of justice to the leaking of a house's roof, causing the roof to rot and ultimately collapse. And to compound the problem, the people of the land are also idle and indulgent in laughter, feasting, drinking, And they think that money is the solution to everything. Just following the example of their leaders who eat and drink and carelessly spend the taxpayers' money. You talk about a situation that is not only out of a person's control, but also hard to live with. Governments led by a hierarchy of officials who are either incompetent, impulsive, and simple-minded, or naive, vain, and insecure. Hello? I mean, is this one of those that you go, I see it. We experience it. Again, it's just example after example after example. Have you had enough? Do you understand what Solomon wants to teach you through all of these examples? Folly is bad. Folly is destructive. It ruins and spoils things. It can destroy kingdoms. It can destroy homes. On the other hand, wisdom has immense value, but it must be employed wisely, and its limitations must be acknowledged. We can't use the wise principles of Scripture in the ways that Job's friends used it. We can't use it as a formula to protect ourselves against all trouble. Solomon reminds us that living according to the teaching of Proverbs will protect us from a lot of them. He who walks with the wise men will be wise. The wise woman builds her house. The way of the lazy is a hedge of thorns. An angry man stirs up strife, and a hot-tempered man abounds in transgression. But we don't put our trust in our ability to manage our lives in certain situations. We don't put our confidence in our skill or in our intellect or in our wisdom. The sovereign God is our high and strong tower. So Solomon says, live wisely and skillfully under the sun. But be on guard against the idolatrous desires in your heart. And be on guard against the temptation to use good things in foolish ways, trying to get what you want or to protect yourself from adversity. Now, all that sets the stage for next week. And I know we got spring break next week. We might have some people that miss, but I hope you can catch the second part. Because all this sets the stage for next Sunday, where we're going to consider our response to what Solomon just laid out. Solomon has made it clear that we don't know the future. He's made the case that the circumstances of our lives are for the most part out of our control, but simply acknowledging those realities is not enough. In fact, those realities may actually lead us to draw the wrong conclusions and to respond in sinful ways to the things that are going on in our lives. Once again, we need God's wisdom on the matter to guard our hearts against two sinful responses when we consider our inability to know and to control the future. We're going to look at each one of those things. Can you guess what they are? Bitter frustration. That's the first one. And it comes up in verse 20. And then the first number of verses in the next chapter, paralyzing anxiety. Those are the two sinful ways that we respond to these unpleasant things, to the realities of what's actually going on. So we're in this struggle between, we have this wisdom from God, we're trying to apply it, but we can be very idolatrous in that, and we can expect things to play out in certain ways, and God doesn't give us a guarantee that things are going to happen in the details the way that we always want them. And so when things don't play out the way that we want them to, in our own personal lives and even in the broader picture of even society, we look out into society and we see these things, our tendencies, and he hits them head on, is to become frustrated, bitterly frustrated, or to be paralyzed by fear and anxiety. To have what they call decision phobia. Basically, it's a fear of making decisions. And he's going to tell us no. In fact, it's going to tie in maybe to some things you guys have been talking about in Corinthians regarding giving and generosity. So we'll look at those two sinful responses, bitter frustration and paralyzing anxiety. Because this, when you see these verses, what you see is that everything up to this point, except for one place in all the verses we just covered, are basically indicatives. It's just making statements. Solomon says, I've seen this, I've observed this. I've experienced this. But then he gets to this point and he starts giving you imperatives to basically say, in light of everything I just said, here's how you should live now, and here's how you should respond to these things that can be frustrating at times in your life as a believer. So we'll look at those two things next week. Hopefully you can join us.